Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to American History. We continue to read from The American Story, Conversations with Master Historians, host of Bloomberg TV's David Rubenstein Show. David Rubenstein captures the brilliance of our most celebrated historians, as well as the souls of their subjects. Last week, we continued the conversation between David Rubenstein and historian H.W. Brands about Ronald Reagan. H.W. Brands is the author of the book Reagan, the Life, as well as books about numerous subjects such as Ben Franklin, Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson. We covered Reagan's election twice as California governor, his losing attempt to secure the Republican nomination for the presidency in 1968, probably because he was too conservative for the party at that time, and his campaign against Gerald Ford for the Republican nomination as president in 1976, which caused a split in the party. We now continue the conversation between David Rubenstein and H.W. Brands about Ronald Reagan. Rubenstein, so in 1980, Ronald Reagan runs for president, and he loses the Iowa caucuses to the surprise of many people. Then Reagan turns it around in New Hampshire. What happened there that became so famous? Brands, what Reagan demonstrated is that if you have stage presence, if you know how to cultivate television cameras, if you know how to deal with the media, you can go far. Reagan seizes the stage in one of the New Hampshire debates and shows this commanding presence. This wasn't the first time, nor was it the last time, but Reagan demonstrated that one-liners, sound bites, if you may, can take you a long way in politics. Again and again, this would convince Americans that Reagan was the kind of guy that they could identify with. Much of the support for him had very little to do with his policies per se. It had everything to do with Reagan's personality. The notion that this is a guy that I would like, this is a guy who has a sense of humor. I cannot overstate the importance of Reagan's sense of humor in his political success. He used to open every nearly speech he made with a joke. The jokes ranged from kind of banal to silly. They were never particularly profound. They were mildly clever at times, but there would be a ripple of laughter that would run through the audience. And as people laughed, they would think, maybe this guy's not so bad after all. Rubenstein, Reagan ultimately does get the nomination, finally, in the Republican Party in 1980. All of a sudden, there's a discussion of making Gerald Ford, the sitting president, as the vice president on the ticket, on the theory that Reagan isn't really qualified to be president because he doesn't know enough. Why did that fall apart? Brands, the idea that Gerry Ford, as president, might become the vice presidential nominee was one of the worst ideas ever floated in American politics. It was also a demonstration of something that would become characteristic of Reagan's presidency. He allowed bad ideas to develop below his level of recognition and consciousness. Reagan went out to Palm Springs to talk to Gerry Ford at his home in Rancho Mirage, California, basically to mend fences. Ford was still sore at Reagan for not campaigning for him more vigorously in 1976 after Reagan was defeated by Ford for the nomination that year. Ford and various people associated with him thought that Reagan's challenge in 1976 and the fact that he had not campaigned for Ford in that fall's election had cost Ford the election. Reagan was an easygoing guy, not a political strategist. He didn't think this stuff through. It's unclear who first suggested it, but the idea was that they were going to have this super ticket with Reagan as the presidential nominee and Ford as a vice presidential nominee. Somehow word got out to the press. Once the people who were, I'll call them the professionals in the campaign, started thinking it through, they realized that there were some overwhelming stumbling blocks. For instance, we would have to address the presidential nominee as Governor Reagan and the vice presidential nominee as President Ford. Reader's note, Gerald Ford was defeated by Jimmy Carter in 1976 for the presidency. The adults on the campaign came to Reagan and said, "Governor, this isn't going to work." Rubenstein, the person he ultimately picked as his vice presidential running mate, was somebody who had criticized Reagan for espousing voodoo economics, and who, in Reagan's view, had not done a very good job at the New Hampshire debate during the run-up to the nomination in 1980. Why did he pick George H.W. Bush to be his running mate? Brands, in large part because they needed somebody really fast. They have to get rid of the story about Ford being the vice presidential nominee, and almost in the same news cycle, come up with a substitute nominee. Reagan, the people around him, are thinking, well, who's available and credible? Who's not going to cause us any trouble? George Bush was the name that came up, and he was willing, so he gets the nomination. Rubenstein, in the general election then, in November of 1980, there's one debate with Jimmy Carter, who is the sitting president and also the Democratic nominee for re-election. Was Reagan a skilled debater? That famous line he came up with, "There you go again," during the debate. Did he think of that line in advance before the debate? Brands, Reagan was a master of one-liners, and he thought this one through. He was trying to figure out where he would drop it in during the debate. Reagan was not a particularly skilled debater and understood that his strengths probably didn't show up particularly well in debates. He recognized that Jimmy Carter was a master of policy to a degree that he never was, and that Carter might very well best him in a debate. I told you at the very beginning that the thing I had to figure out was not what made Reagan tick, but what made him successful. One of the things he realized was that a president does not have to master all the details of every policy. He has to establish an atmosphere, a sense of leadership, some guiding principles. Reagan also recognized that things were moving in his favor. He had been trying for the presidency since 1964, in a formal way since 1968, and he realized that by 1980, the country had shifted in his direction. He's going to say in his first inaugural address as president that in this present crisis, and I have to stress the phrase, in this present crisis, government is not the solution, it is the problem. The initial phrase is often ignored, with people saying that Reagan was the enemy of government forever and ever, which is not true. When I was interviewing people for the book, one of them said, "We were conservatives, we were not anarchists." Anyways, Reagan realized that things were moving in his direction by 1980. The 1960s and 70s were a hard period for the American dream, the idea that this country is getting better all the time. The 60s and 70s were decades of riots in the cities, of Vietnam, and the stumbling of the economy. At the end of the 1970s, we had the American hostage crisis in Iran, and the perceived notion that America was weak and unable to deal with its problems around the world. Jimmy Carter was in deep trouble, and Reagan knew that all he had to do during the election was to present an alternative, a notion that America is actually getting better. I'm not going to say this to the audience that Reagan was the only American conservative who was at the same time an optimist. But if you think about it for a minute, conservatives by nature tend to be pessimists. The reason you're conservative is that you think change is usually for the worse. Reagan was a conservative, and his philosophy was 100% Barry Goldwater's. But he was also an optimist. He had as much faith in the American future as anybody in American politics. In some ways, what Reagan did was to marry the political philosophy of Barry Goldwater with the political style of Hubert Humphrey. It's a formula for victory, as Reagan won in 1980, defeating Jimmy Carter, the incumbent. Rubenstein. So Reagan gets elected overwhelmingly. He then names as his chief of staff Jim Baker, the man who had been Bush's campaign manager during the primary season and previously had served as Gerald Ford's campaign manager. Where did the idea of making Jim Baker his chief of staff come from? Brands, Reagan was not one who overthought personnel decisions, but at times he had good instincts. He observed that Jimmy Carter brought his Georgia Mafia with him to Washington, and they basically spurned the idea that they had to have any Washington expertise at the time. Reagan usually measured his presidency by what he perceived as the failure of the Carter presidency. Something in Reagan and some of the advice that he got said, "We need somebody who knows the ways of Washington, D.C., somebody who's not a true believer, somebody who will not accept what Reagan says simply because Reagan says it." James Baker was somebody who fit that bill. In some ways, Jim Baker became the model of a White House chief of staff. Rubenstein, was that Nancy Reagan's idea to make him chief of staff? Brands, it's not at all clear that Nancy chose Jim Baker, but she wanted someone who was more of a professional than the true believers from California. Rubenstein, at the beginning of the Reagan administration, his highest priority is the tax cut legislation. How did he get through a Democratic Congress a massive tax cut that was against what many Democrats believed or wanted? Brands, Reagan campaigned on and promoted the idea of tax cuts and spending cuts. When he became president, the litmus test for conservatives, especially Republican conservatives, was a balanced budget. The way you balance a budget, especially if you're a conservative, is that you cut taxes, but you have to cut spending as well. Reagan runs for office on this idea. That is, we're going to shrink government and we're going to balance the budget. He pointed to the deficits that dated from the Great Society days of the 1960s of Kennedy and Johnson as something that needed to be fixed. But he made what I call a tactical decision. He did not think of it as a strategic decision in 1981 after he assumed office. Reagan realized that the nature of politics was such that he could get the tax cuts through, but he couldn't get all the spending cuts through, in part because he had exempted defense, he exempted Social Security from tax cuts, from spending cuts, pardon me, he exempted the big ticket items. So he really had to gouge the discretionary spending. Even that was a stretch, a tough haul to cut spending there. What Reagan eventually got in 1981 was tax cuts written in stone and spending cuts to be determined. I still haven't figured out whether Reagan simply overestimated his persuasiveness or underestimated the stubbornness of Democratic Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill and the Democrats on the spending side. For the rest of his presidency, and indeed until the end of his life, Reagan said, "I'm still a balanced budget guy. It was just those prolific Democrats who insisted on their big spending programs." But any realist would have said, once you've gotten your tax cuts, a lot of the pressure on people to give you the spending cuts is gone. Tax cuts are comparatively easy. Spending cuts are harder. Some of the big deficits of the 1980s and up until today date back to Reagan's presidency. The national debt doubled in real terms. The amount of debt that has been run up since George Washington's presidency to 1980, that much again was accumulated just during Reagan's presidency of 8 years. Rubenstein. So there was an assassination attempt on Reagan in March of the first year of his administration, 1981. How close did Reagan come to death? Brands, if we measure it, probably a half an inch or so. That's basically how far the bullet was from his heart. It might have been even closer than that, because Reagan didn't realize initially that he had been hit by the bullet. He heard the shots. He was shoved in the back of the presidential limousine, and his Secret Service agent came in on top of him to shield him. Reagan felt this pain, and he thought that he had broken a rib by hitting it on the hump of the car as he got in. They first head towards the White House to get him safe there, but then Reagan coughs up blood. so they turn and go to George Washington University Hospital. He still has no idea that he has been badly wounded. He insists on walking from the limousine into the hospital. He gets inside the double doors of the hospital and passes out. He nearly collapses on the floor, but he's surrounded by Secret Service and hospital personnel, so they prevent him from whacking his head on the floor, and then they realize he had been hit. It took the surgeons a while to figure out exactly where the slug was. It took them even longer to figure out how they could get it out. They worried that they might actually cause more damage because the bullet had ricocheted off the limousine and had flattened out. So it was this almost ninja-like disc with sharp edges. Every time it moved, it risked doing more damage to Reagan's internal organs. The surgeons were finally able to get it out, but it was a very close call, a closer call than the public knew at the time. Rubenstein. So Reagan survives, and later in his first term, he tries to get other legislation passed through Congress. What was the most significant thing that he accomplished in his first term other than spending cuts? Brands. That was the most important. The next thing in terms of legislation was the bolstering of Social Security in 1983. Rubenstein. Some people say the assassination attempt on Reagan affected him mentally and he never was quite as sharp afterwards. Do you agree with that? Brands. Perhaps out of delicacy, you declined to mention Bill O'Reilly's book, Killing Reagan. Its basic thesis is that the shooting in 1981 eventually led to Reagan's death in 2004. My thinking on this is that if something happens to you when you are 70 years old that kills you over two decades later, that's a lethality we can all live with. There are those who claim O'Reilly is one, along with his co-author, that somehow triggered Reagan's failing memory. Now, his memory quite clearly didn't fail after he left the White House. The question of whether he had become forgetful while he was president was one that I had to deal with. Everybody's looking at the Reagan presidency closely has to look at the possibility. There were certain moments when it was an issue that became quite public. When Reagan was running for re-election in 1984, he had two debates with Walter Mondale, the Democratic candidate who was a senator from Minnesota. In the first debate, Reagan was uncharacteristically clumsy and fluxumed. This is a trained actor. A guy who knows how to memorize his lines. He tripped over his opening statement, which everybody memorizes. He tripped over his closing statement, repeated himself. People who watched this debate became kind of embarrassed for Reagan. The next day, the Wall Street Journal, the Reagan-friendly, Republican-friendly Wall Street Journal, had a masthead headline that asked, "Is Reagan too old to be president?" This was the first time the issue was raised in a serious way about his age. Ron Reagan, Reagan's youngest child, said in a memoir he wrote after his father died that he watched this debate and became convinced that this was the first public sign of what eventually would be diagnosed as Alzheimer's disease. Ron Reagan was pillared for this view, and he was sort of forced to retract it. But it's an issue that did come up. Reagan didn't really address the issue at all. He just made people laugh about it. People could say, he's got a sense of humor. If he's laughing it off, we can laugh it off too. There were various people who observed Reagan during his second term and that he was clearly slowing down. John Poindexter, who was his national security advisor at the time of the Iran-Contra scandal during Reagan's presidency, told me in an interview that he thought Reagan's failing memory was part of the Iran-Contra stuff. Rubenstein, what about Reagan's children? He had four children, but he seemed to have no relationship with them while he was president. What was that about? Brands. This goes back to what I was saying earlier, that Reagan seemed to have an emotional universe that could encompass Nancy, but almost no one else. Reagan was friendly, but had no real friends. I have thought that if he had not ever been politically important, if he hadn't been famous in that way, nobody would have come to his funeral. There was nobody outside of Nancy that he confided in. He didn't reveal much of himself to anybody, and his kids often felt on the outside of this. When they were young, sometimes they attributed to the fact that their father and Ronald Reagan's first wife, Jane Wyman, the mother of his first two kids, were both Hollywood actors and they were both busy. But it was more than that, Reagan just didn't have room in his emotional world for the kids. There's a very telling moment when his son Michael is about to graduate from high school, except that he doesn't have enough credits and he's been bouncing from one school to another. The boarding school he's attending says, "Well, we will allow you to graduate if you can get your father to give the commencement address." So Michael calls up his dad and says, "Dad, can you come down and give the commencement address?" Reagan is thrilled because he was not sure that Mike was ever going to graduate from high school. He goes down there and he's in politician mode, working the room with the graduates. He says, "Hi, I'm Ronald Reagan. What's your name?" "Johnny Smith." "Hi, I'm Ronald Reagan. What's your name?" "Mary Jones." "Hi, I'm Ronald Reagan. What's your name?" "Dad," he didn't even recognize his own son. Michael tells his story in his memoirs. Rubenstein, one last question. Is that hair really his? No dye on the hair? Brands, was his hair really that black his whole life? Reagan claimed it was, and I never found evidence to the contrary. Being a responsible historian, if I don't have evidence, I can't say. Well, that wraps up the conversation between David Rubenstein and H.W. Brands about Ronald Reagan. We now turn to the last conversation in the book, The American Story, that I've been reading for some time. And the conversation is between David Rubenstein and Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. of the U.S. Supreme Court. And before we get into the conversation between the two men, here is David Rubenstein's introduction to Justice Roberts. The legal world has produced in every generation a few individuals who seem destined to rise to the top of the profession. John G. Roberts, Jr. is one of those individuals. An honors graduate of Harvard College, he made it through in 3 years, and an honors graduate of Harvard Law School, where he was a managing editor of the Harvard Law Review, a clerk for Judge Henry J. Friendly of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, a clerk for Supreme Court Justice William H. Rehnquist, a special assistant to the Attorney General of the United States, an associate White House counsel, the principal deputy solicitor general, and one of the finest Supreme Court advocates in recent decades. But life really goes forward without setbacks. John Roberts had one back in 1992 when he was nominated to be a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit by then-President George H.W. Bush. The end of the first Bush presidency arrived before the U.S. Senate acted on Roberts' nomination to the appellate court, and so Roberts remained in private practice for another 11 years. Roberts might well have stayed there for the rest of his legal career. A lawyer who wants to be a judge rarely gets a second bite at the apple. But in 2001, President George W. Bush, recognizing the obvious legal talent of John Roberts, nominated him again to the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. The Senate confirmed him in 2003. 2 years later, with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's retirement from the Supreme Court, President Bush nominated Roberts to be her successor on the bench. However, before the Senate could consider the nomination, Chief Justice William Rehnquist passed away, and President Bush then nominated John Roberts to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Roberts was confirmed in September 2005 by the U.S. Senate. With that, he became, at the age of 50, the youngest Chief Justice in 200 years. It's not considered appropriate to ask a sitting justice about the reasoning behind a particular decision or the possible outcomes of future cases, so our conversation today does not include those kinds of subjects. but it does nonetheless offer interesting, even rare, insights into the court and its current, still quite young, Chief Justice. Chief Justice Roberts provided an inside look at how the Supreme Court operates, how cases are selected to be considered, how oral arguments are used, how the cases are voted upon and assigned for opinion writing, how the opinions are drafted and announced, and how the collegiality among the justices is generally maintained, despite wide ideological differences in many areas. The Chief Justice might never have the chance to lead the court, he reveals in our conversation, but for a chance encounter while he was an undergraduate student at Harvard College, Roberts expected to be an historian after he graduated from Harvard, and he was a history major. But during a taxi cab ride in Boston, Massachusetts, the taxi driver mentioned that he too had gone to Harvard College and he too had majored in history. That prompted John Roberts, back then, to expand his academic interests and to pursue a career in the law, less likely to force him to be driving cabs after graduation. Well, that wraps up this edition of American History, and we'll stop right there. We'll continue next week with the conversation between David Rubenstein and Chief Justice John Roberts about the Supreme Court. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'll be back with you next week for the next edition of American History. Thank you so much for listening.